Hello and welcome to What a Scream, the horror movie podcast where I, your host, Egrain, chats with a special guest every week about horror films. And we discuss two films that have to do with a particular subject that I've previously randomly chosen. Now, this week is all about a subject that I'm not a massive fan of. I'm going to be very honest. It wouldn't be... Okay, so a lot of people are like, this kind of subject isn't really horror. It's creature feature, by the way. The subject is creature feature this week. So we're talking sharks, weird, blobby aliens from outer space, and crocodiles and anacondas. It's not really a subgenre of horror that I find scary. I did not find Jaws scary. I know a lot of people are like, oh, shark movies make me scared to go into the water. I'm a water baby. So I'm like, you know what? If I get eaten by a sea creature, so be it. Bury me at sea. They're very cheesy, a lot of these films. And I know sometimes cheese is really good and I'm not going to yuck anybody's yum. But for me personally, it's just... not something I would reach for. However, saying that, one of the films we explored in this week actually changed my mind a wee little tiny bit about creature feature films. So my guest this week is Matt from Is Paul Dano OK? podcast, and together we are chatting about 1988's The Blob, which is the remake of the 1950s film, and we are also talking about Lake Placid from 1999. So enjoy our chat about creature features and these two films. So I would like to welcome to What a Scream for the very first time, Matt Brothers. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Would you like to introduce yourself and let people know what you do?
Sure thing. Yeah. So I'm a writer and a filmmaker on the side, alongside all the day job stuff. And then I also do many, many podcasts. So primarily there is Paul Dano OK? Which is a filmography deep dive into the actor Paul Dano, tallying up all the injuries and punishment he puts himself through in all his many varied roles. There is also Spotlight, the Star Trek podcast from three non-Trekkies, which I started with two of my best mates about 6 years ago. That was for us to go through the Star Trek movie canon and see, from the perspective of people who weren't that into Star Trek, and see if by the end of that we would become Trekkies, because there's no shortage of Star Trek podcasts out there, but they're always really dumb by the people who know it back and forth. So we go, let's take this different approach. And then after we did the movies, we just kind of kept going and dive into all the series and interviews and spin-offs and all sorts of things. So that's really fun. And then there's also Sudden Double Deep as well, which I do with my Is Paul Dano OK? co-host Daryl Bear. On that show, we watch three films linked by a word in the title. So pick a word out of a hat, and then we try and watch three films that share that word, and we try and spread it out so it's a different cross mix of genres, of decades, of countries, of origins, of all sorts that we can. So we try and maybe avoid some of the more obvious picks for some of the words and go a bit deeper, but some of the words that come out, there really do seem to only be three films that have that word, or there's films of a very certain type. So you get stuff like Endgame or Judgment, or the words that come after like a colon or like the fourth sequel to something. You're like, well, this is going to be a string of those type of films, and it often is. But that's really fun, and that's a weekly show as well. Well, fortnightly for the main show, and then deepers the little bonuses in between.
Great. And how did you get into horror? And do you remember what the first horror film was you ever saw?
Yeah, it was... it was probably either a toss-up between, from what I can remember, some of the more horrific elements of T2. So not necessarily a straight horror, but I remember catching moments of that on a TV when I was way too young. Primarily the sharpened arm through the mouth and the milk bottle moment, and being like, "Oh shit, you know, this is beyond me," and I love it. And then I think Evil Dead 2. So that was probably the first one I caught. So I remember being at a sleepover at a friend's house when we were both still too young for that, but old enough to be curious and to be like staying up late and checking out TV and flicking onto it on like BBC Two at like 1:20 in the morning or something, and completely having it go way over our heads that it's, a horror comedy, and just being absolutely horrified by what we were seeing for the longest time. So that's probably where it all began, really. Yeah, catching stuff on TV I shouldn't have been.
It seems to be like quite a constant thing for horror fans is like accidentally catching things on TV. I remember when I was very little, and I caught Suspiria on
Oh,
TV
wow.
and had no clue what was going on. And it's just I didn't even know it was Suspiria until like a couple of years ago. And I was like, oh, that's why I am the way I am. Makes so
Yeah.
much sense.
Yeah, I wonder if that rite of passage has been diminished a bit now with not as many people, I guess, watching, I guess, terrestrial TV in a way. Although I guess when you're growing up and you're in your parents' house still, you probably do have access. But back then, it really was the era of having a little TV in your room, but it's only the four channels. Or in the case of my friend's house where we saw Evil Dead 2, he was linked to like his mum's Sky downstairs. But it was still that old school way of whoever was watching would control it. So we'd be watching stuff sometimes, and then suddenly the channels would start changing on their own. And it's his mum being like, nope, this is changing now. So that sort of thing. But yeah, in this era now with well, the internet for one, and streaming and everything, I wonder if you can still stumble on the wrong stuff accidentally without deliberately going out and seeking it.
It saddens me that like the next generation may never get the Channel 4 rite of passage. It
Yeah.
seems everyone was watching Channel 4 and accidentally saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something. So our topic for this episode is creature feature, which I'm going to admit is not my bag. Not really big into because there seems to be like two kind of subgenres within this subgenre, which is like alien creature feature, or it's like crocodiles, sharks, anacondas, and neither of them really appeal to me. So, what is your relationship like with creature features? Are you a fan?
Yeah, I guess because yeah, you're right. It does kind of break down into many subgenres within it. There's definitely the ones where it's humans versus a beast of some kind, and then there's, I guess, the subgenres in there. You got sort of disaster flicks as well, kind of crossover, and kaiju films as well. And I guess that's where my love comes from because I'm a big Godzilla fan. So primarily that whole area. So the original Godzilla is one of my favorite films, and in the first lockdown, I managed to get all the Showa era films done. So from 54 through to 75, there's that amazing, huge Criterion box set of all of them, which is a very, very expensive set. But during lockdown, I was signed up to Cinema Paradiso, which is, one of the only, I think, physical disc rental services still going, especially now that I think Netflix have finally ended their disc thing, which I had no idea was still a thing.
No, I didn't know. And then someone put it up the other day being like, this is the last Netflix disc. I was like, what?
Yeah, like, oh, okay, well done. Still going. And Cinema Paradiso did a thing when the lockdowns first started where, because, do you remember, like, all the postal service went a bit skewy as well? Well, they were like, oh, if you're signed up to a two disc thing a month, we'll just send you four. But the idea being like, oh, this will tide you over for longer. But of course, for me, it was just more of a challenge of like, well, now I'll just watch four films immediately and send them straight back and get more four. So I managed to do that entire Criterion set via renting all the individual discs, which was a great hack to do that. So fantastic seeing all of those as well. And then you've got your other sort of Toho Studio spin-offs like Mothra, and then also all the Gamera stuff as well. So lots of the old sort of kaiju films kind of got me in. But then there's very much a sort of tiered system, I think, with the creature feature stuff, where you've got your early 50s like B movies like Them and the original Blob and things like that, very, very close to sci-fi, often more sci-fi than horror. And then your 70s is kind of this like wild west of just everything doing what it says on the tin. So you got stuff like frogs, the killer bees, dogs, so often one ape, all these are orca, the giant killer whale ones, so all ones like that. And also some really good gems in there, like Kingdom of the Spiders, which stars William Shatner, and that's one we covered on Sun Double Deep as well, which is a really good sort of mid-70s, there's a bunch of tarantulas everywhere, isn't it, horrible type film. And then I guess the granddaddy of them is Jaws, of course, which probably, probably is my favorite, because that definitely is one of my favorite films. And then it feels like it had a bit of a mini second heyday, perhaps in like the 90s, when you were getting not prestige picks, you know, I guess Lake Placid is also one of them, but like proper films done at that cusp of big practical effects are in their kind of waning days, but they look really great. And the onset of early CG, which maybe sets them back a bit. But then compared to now, it feels like the landscape nowadays is a mix of either really low budget stuff or contained films, stuff like Crawl, that other alligator film, and then just all the stuff that's awash of like the like Killer Shark versus whoever. And there's so many of these now, and I think especially more in the wake of stuff like the Meg and everything. I mean, I guess the Meg was a big blockbuster attempt at one as well. But yeah, so many kind of just really cheap looking things thrown together like that. And it feels like Cocaine Bear is a really good sort of throwback as well. And I think that's already immediately going to inspire a lot of imitators. So yeah, as a genre, it's like a really interesting timeline to see kind of what the trends were and what survived. And I think it's one that could keep coming back properly, like give a real like A-list cast a bit of a B movie to do again and do it really well, and you know, go back to practical, and I think you can have some real fun.
Yeah, I think for me, like the more kind of Animal Kingdom creature features, whenever I always kind of were gunning more for the animals and the creatures than I was the humans. I was like, you've come into their natural habitat and you're trying to destroy them. Fuck you.
Did you have an animal that was a particular like fear, like one that was a bit of a phobia? Because it felt like there were so many.
No, you know what? When I was younger, it was birds, but that was because we kept chickens and we had a rooster that was really violent and aggressive. So that was why I had a fear of birds.
That could
But
be one that hasn't been done. Just
right,
rooster.
rooster,
The
cockerel. So yeah, Alfred Hitchcock's birds was a
Yeah.
bit of a ugh for me. But other than that, you know, there was like arachnid. That was another one, wasn't it? That was kind of out when I was a
Yeah.
bit younger.
And arachnophobia as well, the
Yeah. And
early 90s.
no, just like even Jaws. Like, I've heard so many people have been like, Jaws really fucked me up. I cannot go into the water now. And I'm just like, meh. If it's gonna happen, it's gonna happen. So yeah, they've never really affected me all that much. So let's kick off then with your choice, which I'm gonna say it was an interesting one. I was quite surprised by it, to be fair. Do you want to introduce it and give us a brief synopsis, please?
Yeah, sure. So this is Chuck Russell's 1988 remake of The Blob.
If it had a mind, you could reason with it. If it had a body, you could shoot it. If it had a heart, you could kill it. Now, man is no longer the supreme being on this planet.
The organism is growing at a geometric rate. By all accounts, it's at least 1,000 times its original mass.
Nobody believes me about what happened tonight.
What did happen?
You were there, you saw.
Plasmic life form that hunts its prey. Predator.
Also titled The Blob, remake of the 1958 film of the same name, which starred Steve McQueen. And yeah, for a while I was thinking like, what area of creature feature do I even pick for this episode? And then this one came back around as like, oh, it's harkening back to the 50s sci-fi tinge stuff, but it's very much in the horror sphere, certainly a lot more than the original was. And the 80s was rife with this, of filmmakers who obviously grew up being influenced by the 50s genre pictures, doing them again on bigger budgets and, you know, marginally bigger budgets, and the modern effects of the time. So obviously Carpenter's The Thing being the other big example of an 80s remake of a 50s film. And this is a fascinating sort of cross-section of 50s as a decade and 80s as a decade. Like, we get it in stuff like Back to the Future as well, how that's 80s modern day back to the 50s. And I think if you went another 30 years on, you're in the 2010s, and it feels like certain films like this would be great to see a new edition every 30 years. So if the 2010s missed out on The Blob, I'm way up for doing a new Blob remake myself, and pinching that one. But yeah, so this is this is a film I'd seen once before, I think, and I was really impressed with how it did balance everything from the sci-fi to the horror to the practical effects, especially, and mixing modern and old techniques as well. And yeah, it's basically about a meteorite crashing in California, and this blob. Well, so they say a meteorite crashing in California, mm-hmm. and this blob-like substance coming out and slowly devouring people and gaining in size. And we have this interesting sort of initially a triangle of characters of Kevin Dillon's Brian, and then Shawnee Smith's Meg, and Donovan Leitch's Paul. So Meg and Paul are sort of your more traditional leading couple kind of characters, and Brian Flagg is this sort of, you know, the almost like the McQueen rogue rebel type guy. But then quite early on, you know, we lose Paul quite suddenly to the blob, and suddenly the focus shifts for a Brian and Meg pairing for the rest of the film, which is an interesting mm-hmm. spin. And I think the director said, you know, he took that from the Hitchcock playbook of upending expectations early on.
So before we kind of get into it, why did you choose the 80s version and not the 50s version?
I thought it would be more fun, definitely more fun and a lot more sort of going on, because I hadn't seen the, I mean, I picked this one before I'd seen the 50s one, but I did watch the 50s mm-hmm. one just the other day for reference sake. And it is, a lot of the reviews on Letterboxd especially were ones I kind of gelled with, which were saying, like, you know, not enough blob. Where's the blob? Whenever the blob's not on screen, people are asking, where's the blob? And it is a very kind of eerily dry sort of picture. Like, it's McQueen's mm-hmm. debut. He was 28 at the time, looking about 40 and playing a teenager in classic 50s fashion. But yeah, I feel like this one, there's a lot more to talk about, really. And the fact that it's kind of hearkening to what came before is very reminiscent of filmmaking of the time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, feels a lot more current.
Yeah. So I kind of took from it that it was, you know, like I said, the original was about like the threat of an alien invasion, whereas this one was a lot more of kind of suspicious conspiracy, kind of distrust of the government. So what did you think of that theme kind of compared to the original?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. Like, it's I think it just kind of gets going really quickly as well compared to the original, especially, like, you know, it's and the idea of the blob itself starting as this smaller like pale goo stuff, it gets stuck on this this guy's hand in this park at the start and just starts devouring them away, and then as it goes, it gets bigger and bigger, and yeah, it's just really, it feels a lot more sort of grindhousey as well, and a lot more like, I think like Planet Terror with the hospital set kind of horror stuff owes a lot to this as well, and just early on, just upping the stakes in a way. With that guy who gets it and is suddenly just like, you know, just half a guy left, and then poor Paul getting stummed. But yeah, I think they play some interesting stuff with distrust of the government throughout. And, you know, there's the governmental characters are always kind of there and on the periphery and become more involved as it goes on as well.
Yeah. Like, from what I don't know too much about American history, obviously, because it seems a bit crazy and always kind of about to implode. But the 80s was really, weren't they really kind of like still a bit, there was obviously in the 70s, there was all about the communists. And then it came the 80s and they were like, actually, our government's a bit shit as well. And there was just this real terror about like biological weapons. And we see this in the film where we've got this governmental agencies walking around in their hazmat suits. And it's all a bit shady. And, you know, are they going to use it as a weapon? Did they make it, you know, is it really from a meteor? And then we've got the character of Kevin Dillon's character, where he's like rebel without a cause with his leather jacket and his long hair and his motorbike. And so it's really funny how they've chosen to go kind of similar to like the 50s. They're gonna like portray this rebel who's against, kind of questioning authority, and he's in his leather jacket and bicycle. It's kind of, I kind of like that hark back to the 50s.
Yeah, I think that's an element that either carried over into the 80s or was an element they were referencing a lot anyway. When you think of sort of teen bullies of the era, they're still quite greaser-like in their characterization. And, you know, stuff like Christine as well, which I guess is also a creature feature with the evil car, has similar kind of bullies. And it's interesting, I think, that what this film does is push that archetype of a character into being the hero, essentially, which still feels really really fresh and new, because, you know, Paul is set up as this all-American sort of boy, and then I think it's like 24 minutes in, he's eaten by the blob. He's like, oh shit. and then whether it's just because I'm so used to Kevin Dillon from stuff like Entourage as a girl Johnny Drama, you just don't really expect him to be pushed to be like the hero. But I think he makes for a really interesting double act with him and Shawnee Smith, who I think a lot of people will know from the Saw films. Mm. I primarily did as well. And so when I was watching this for the first time, which was only a few years ago, I think for like the first half, I was like, who is this? Who I think I recognize her. Oh, it's Thingy from Saw. So yes, and you know, so she gets pushed to be sort of final girl status as well, between her and Kevin Dillon.
Yeah, that shocked me when she turned up, and I was like, she is not that old, is she?
Yeah, because she feels young in Saw.
Yeah. So what did you think of the creature effects of the blob itself?
It's so good. It's like, you know, the thing is rightly held up as, you know, this landmark in gloopy effects, mm-hmm. shall we say, like, you know, the practicality of stuff and just going full gloop. And there's a Sun Devil Deep episode we did recently where oh my god, I can't remember what it's called, but it's this other blob slime based kind of horror, real mm-hmm. dirty film from the 80s, and we were talking a lot about the gloopy films of the era. And I think, you know, if you took a shot every time I said gloop or goop in the episode, you'd be dead. And it's something I miss. Like, I really want it to sort of come back, because it feels like too many films now go the CG route. But stuff like this, like 1988 feels like a perfect kind of place to land in terms of, you know, you're 5 or 6 years on from The Thing. So you're perfecting practical effects, and you're just on the cusp of CG. And I love how when the blob gets really big, they harken back and do sort of stop motion effects from the looks of things, where it goes almost very Harryhausen.
Yeah.
Which in itself kind of does harken back to how it would have been done in the 50s as well, rather than attempt really rudimentary CG. I think filmmakers said there's a tiny bit of early CG in here, but it's just mm-hmm. for like adding sparkles to bits. You know, it's nothing blob creating. But yeah, all the sort of one-to-one blob attacks are great. Like when it takes Paul in the hospital early on, that was genuinely him just underneath, like almost being like waterboarded or having, like, you know, just blobby gel pulled over his face and pulled back. And he said he felt like he was suffocating during that. So that's great. All the, you know, that acidic melting of body parts, the way it moves, the way it's kind of like crawling on ceilings and dropping down. The guy who gets pulled through the sink is so great, because that's, you know, you can really see, they really sell it with little details, like a shot where you can see like a leg sticking up, but also an arm. And it's like, that's a horrible combination of angles for a guy being pulled down a sink, and then seeing it kind of expand slightly to like suck his head in, and then the woman being like trapped in the phone booth as well as the blob is encasing in, and then just selling it with that one quick shot, which is clearly well, not clearly, because it's really well put in, where I think they use like a smaller model and like a little maquette version of the actress, and then just fire blasted the blob in at like a million miles an hour. And it's just so well done. And I would genuinely love to see a studio attempt something like this now and make it as throwbacky as you want, but to take it seriously and have a go at doing these sort of effects this way, because clearly you can and you could.
Yeah. I mean, they made the blob was like a bag filled with basically like cellulose kind of compound, which, like, I would love to have, you know, when like special effects people are testing out like what would look great, I would love to be in on one of those sessions and be like, what was it, shaving foam? Were they like, what can we do with this blob?
You start thinking, like, I really just want to eat a bit. Can I eat the blob, please?
Right? Like, I talked about the stuff with Tim Coleman a couple of episodes back, and I was just like, I just want to eat it. Like, I know that's the whole thing, that, you know, people eating, but you know, you look at it and you're like, oh, I just want to like stick my finger in it.
Did they bring the stuff out as a tie-in? Or am I just thinking of like the genuine like marshmallow fluff you can buy that is a bit too stuff like?
Apparently there is, like, you can get tubs of the stuff that is basically just marshmallow fluff. But yes. So do you think the blob like you said before, 30 years and another 30 years, do you think the Blob could be remade today, and what kind of angle do you reckon they could take it from?
Yeah, I really think it can. Oh God, as for the angle, yeah, I haven't thought that far ahead, but it feels like you could either do something. It depends whether you go the route of it being an alien entity or chemically engineered. I think, doing another alien story would be really cool. Get a bit of that, Venom symbiote style coming down from Spider-Man. But if it was engineered, or it could be perhaps like a some sort of climate, you could tie in a climate thing. There could be, some big something melt somewhere and out it comes, because as we know, the cold is what defeats the Blob. Which again is a funny, is a nice way of how they updated this one, where they just kind of discover that at towards the end of the original and just go, all right, cool, just ship it out to Alaska and hope it stays cold. Whereas on this one, they get a hint of cold being its Achilles heel quite early on, like in the in an earlier scene, and then it doesn't come back around until the finale, which is pretty fun. So yeah, it could be that, yeah, some natural disaster has unearthed new blob and out it comes. But you could have some real fun with extra populated areas, or take it to outside of a city, maybe like trying a different country, or go really condensed as well, and do like a very specific story about people living. I think I've just got Evil Dead Rise on the brain because I saw it again last night. But you could do like the apartment block version, where it's like, rather than involving everybody in the whole military, you do the War of the Worlds thing almost, of going like, we'll focus on like one small family who just happened to get in the path of the Blob, and it becomes like almost a scaling down from like an aliens to an alien. So it's like almost from big blob versus the world to, oh no, it's us and the Blob is in this building, we can't get out, and it's just us versus this one bit of the Blob. Could be quite interesting as well. But you definitely could go big, of course.
It's got so much possibility with this blob. So would you recommend the blob for horror fans?
Yeah, I think it's one that is slept on a little bit. I think it's a real staple of the genre and of this time period. But I don't think it gets talked about enough. And every time I see this remake specifically, there's all these moments throughout that really make me sit up and take watch again. And it's got some just real badass, like the whole finale out in the street as this blob is giant, versus like the military, and everyone's like fleeing into the building, and they work out, and you got that amazing hero shot of Shawnee Smith coming out with like the gun again. And there's this amazing camera move that kind of like pulls down, looks up at her, and she says some badass line, fires off the gun, and then there's like, I think a street lamp just explodes and sparks behind her. And all in all, it's like a perfect, like, come get some hero shot, or get away from her, you bitch, moment. And I think it deserves more recognition as well. So yeah, I don't know if it's got like a really good release yet in terms of disc. I mean, it must do somewhere, I think. But I think some of the big push for it to come out in an anniversary edition might be enough to get it back out there.
I'd recommend it. Like, it's a good time. It's quite, it's got a bit of a hark back to the original, and it's just a good time film. Like, if you're looking for something that's obviously it's got subtext, but if you're looking for something that's not like incredibly psychologically deep and you just want to have a bit of fun and you like perhaps this kind of creature feature genre, then I definitely recommend. Plus, it's freely available on YouTube, so why not?
Yeah, there is a version on there for sure. And yeah, I think you're right. Like, it's fun. I think what these creature features have is that drive-through aesthetic, which is where a lot of them are playing, like these B movies. And that's something, as a whole, I'd love to see come back. And I think we're on the right track with Cocaine Bear's success to take these films where you just say the title and someone's like, yeah, I'm there, I'm up for like sitting in a car somewhere watching this and eating a load of popcorn. So yeah, eyes are all on the Meg 2 this summer to see how
I haven't even seen the first Meg, so.
that
So let's move on to my choice then. I went with 1999's Lake Placid.
It has existed since prehistoric times. It was worshipped by primitive cultures. It can kill a man with one crushing bite.
We heard a man was bit in half.
Any recent bear attacks?
Bears don't attack people underwater.
Probably a fever then.
What was that?
Whatever's out there, who shot with this, he's dead.
Oh no.
Sheriff, how many deputies you got?
You came here to help you find it.
We can't let him kill it.
Experience a few parts mystery.
Do you have any theories of why he's here?
Honestly, I don't know.
And a few parts missing.
It's a human toe.
Is this the man who was killed?
He seemed taller.
Which is a horror comedy written by David E. Kelly and directed by Stephen Miner. It stars Bill Pullman, Bridget Fonda, Brendan Gleeson, which was a shock for me.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, there he is. Oliver Platt and Betty White, another great addition to the cast. Basically, centers around there's a giant crocodile going around eating people and causing general chaos. And we've got Brendan Gleeson as the sheriff who calls in fish and game officer Jack, played by Bill Pullman. Bridget Fonda is a paleontologist who has gone to kind of figure out what this thing is. Is it prehistoric? Is it, you know, of the time? And then we've got the mythology professor and crocodile enthusiast Hector, and they're all trying to hunt this crocodile, and they come across Betty White, who lives on a farm. Turns out she's been feeding the crocodile.
Ooh, comes down to Betty White, can't be trusted.
She is just chef's kiss in this film. So yeah, it's basically about them trying to trap and this moral quandary of whether to kill the crocodile or keep it for examination. So what is your opinion of Lake Placid?
Yeah, it's really fun. I think it comes at that time I touched upon, you know, this is late 90s now, and there was definitely a resurgence in, maybe if not straight creature features, but definitely like disaster films. You got like your Dante's Peak Volcano, Double Bill, your Armageddon, Deep Impact, Double Bill, Twister, and things like that. And these are quite B-movie-ish pictures, but again, with really big casts, especially Twister. And then you got Bill Pullman from Independence Day coming up in this as well. And so this is another one where it's basically, you know, it's a big crocodile film, but that cast is amazing. They're all really great sort of character actors as well. I definitely really miss Bridget Fonda, with this being one of her last roles before retirement. She's a great presence. But yeah, I can't think when I first saw this, but I had seen it before. So yeah, it's a really great time in that it feels, it's that thing of like, it feels like a real film, you know, because this is one of those franchises that does end up spinning off and having a bunch of sort of direct to DVD sequels that I imagine, I haven't seen them, that are more schlocky and maybe what you'd expect, whereas this kind of takes it quite seriously in terms of, it's not like wall-to-wall horror kills. Like, in fact, the body count is relatively low, and that kind of surprised me on rewatch. But it's more about the characters interacting, debating what to do, and then having these little bursts of sort of adrenaline fueled thrills leading into bigger sort of croc action. But I think the restraint it has kind of surprised me on this go around. Yeah. What about you? Why was this your pick?
I basically just put creature feature into Google. I was looking at, like, you know, the kind of films. I was like, you know what? Like, I've seen Jaws. We could talk about Jaws. Obviously, it's like the biggest, apart from Godzilla, it's probably the biggest creature feature. But I was like, you know what? I'm going to go for a crocodile. I haven't seen a crocodile film, so I'm going to give it a chance. And I actually really enjoyed it. Like, it's so funny, and I think Betty White, Brendan Gleeson, and Oliver Platt are just comedic, like, absolute stars in this. Brendan Gleeson and Oliver Platt's chemistry is fantastic. Like, it's so, and it's something I didn't expect from Brendan Gleeson. I mean, has he got a terrible Southern American accent in this? Absolutely, yes. You can definitely hear he's Irish in this. But it was just so funny, and it's really slapstick. And, you know, I feel like a lot of these creature features, especially ones that are about like giant things, they take themselves far too seriously. Mm. Whereas I feel like this could almost be like an ironic take on those kind of films. And it was just really endearing. And I really also enjoyed the creature effects in this. What about you? What was your opinion on the giant crocodile?
Yeah, well, I mean, the crocodile looks great. Like, again, there's a lot of, you know, 1999... This sort of turn of the century stuff is when you start getting into some potentially sketchy CG eras. It's like it's too early to be done right, but a lot of them tried. And yeah. I think between like 97 and 2001, especially, there's some really badly dated stuff. But this is primarily a big puppet with the odd like CG only shot. I think one of the first times we see it, it is. But yeah, really, really holds up and really doesn't jump out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that what this film gets right is again, it does feel like a harkening back again to like the 50s ones, which were more about the interconnected drama, the characters, and less about the all out mayhem of the creature. And that were also sort of populated by real, quote unquote, you know, real dramatic actors of the time. So I think it takes that element of the past creature features really well, and then adds that layer of comedy to it. So the tonally, it works really well because, you know, it is a horror comedy, but it is doing everything else properly as well. Like it's another entry into creature features of a certain time rather than a full pastiche. So it kind of has its cake and eat it, which is really great. And yeah, you're right. Like, yeah, Brendan Gleeson, I was just like, oh no, I don't remember him in this. Is he? Yep. Oh, he's American. Yep. The most Irish actor out there is being Southern, but it's a testament to him that that doesn't completely pull you out.
Yeah. Yeah. So what did you think about this theme of like nature versus man, and is man encroaching on like, you know, a natural habitat, and they kind of feel like they're, you know, it's either them or the crocodile, even though this is, I mean, I know the crocodile like comes from Asia and it swam, but like if man wasn't there, it would have done that anyway. So what do you think it was kind of trying to say about men or man versus nature?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting debate in here because I like how a lot of it is trying to work out what to do. Like it's not that the crocodile is a deliberately villainous thing, it is just an animal, and a lot of the time in the film there is spent them trying to work out, well, how is it here? Like, first of all, what is it? And then, oh, it's a big crocodile, and how is it here? And they keep saying like, how is this possible? And then they kind of eventually work out that yeah, it could have theoretically swam from Asia and got in from the sea, so there's all these logistical reasons why this is possible. And then it becomes a bit more of like, yeah, of like a, what do we do? Like Betty White's character especially is very much like, well, it's his lake now, yeah, and no one's living on it, so it's fine, right? And I'm just a little bit crazy feeding it cows and maybe my husband. And so yeah, you know, there's, we get a good cross-section of people, those who want to study it and save it. There isn't really that one character who's like, crocodile must die. Like it sort of becomes, starts out as, I guess, Bill Pullman, but even then he's like, I'm just trying to do my job type thing. Like there isn't like a character in the ensemble who's like, oh, this crocodile killed my family 5 years ago and I want it dead. So the lack of making things like personal to begin with is quite a good sign of restraint. And even when it does, you know, leap out and decapitate their fellow officer, even then they don't seem that upset. I mean, they do, but it's like they're not like, right, everybody loved that guy, he's the town's hero, so now we're out to kill it. They remain level-headed, and I think that level of sensible thinking from all characters is what keeps it grounded in a way and can allow it to be more funny on its own terms, because we're not questioning like, oh, why are they doing this, this is such a dumb thing to be doing. Like everything they're doing fits in with this, either the situation or the characters. You know, Oliver Platt's character on more than one occasion gets back in that lake and it's like, dude, but it's like, you know, you buy it from him and from what he believes and the connections he thinks he has with it. And again, I think it's a testament to the film that it doesn't spin that around, because how many times have you seen the thing where the expert gets too cocky and then is the one to go?
One thing I did kind of pull up, and I wasn't sure whether it was like trying to be a reference towards perhaps 1950s portrayal of women, but the female characters, as much as I did love Bridget Fonda in this, the female characters are a bit sappy, aren't they? Like even one of the deputies, you're like, ah, come on, like she's a deputy, she's not gonna act like that, you know. I think at what she's trying to stop Hector getting in the water and she's like, I'll sleep with you. And you're just like, oh my god. So what did you think about the female portrayal? Do you think it was more kind of trying to be that 1950s, or do you think perhaps just in 1999, they were still really badly writing female characters.
I don't know. I think in the late 90s, it came back around to being really bad. And I mean, you know, David E. Kelly, bless him, like, he's massive TV success, you know, Ally McBeal and all this. But I think his track record of nuances in a lot of female characters is sketchy at best. And, you know, this is someone who created, like, you know, female-led shows. But there's, friend of our podcast is this podcast called Bygones, which is an Ally McBeal rewatch podcast. So hearing them go through episode by episode, and they're two sisters who like love the show, but are rightly calling it out on everything that's dated horribly. And there's quite a few things in there. So I imagine it's from that same stable. But yeah, it was a shame to see someone as great as Bridget Fonda playing this sort of very like just moany and like, you know, like slapping people around and yeah, that dynamic, that gender dynamic there was, yeah, definitely aged a lot. I think at best he could say, oh, yeah, this is what it's like in the 50s, and that's what I was doing. But the fact that it's across, you know, Bridget Fonda and Meredith Salinger, as basically the two main women characters in there, it's, not a good look.
Yeah, I mean, Betty White was fantastic. Like, her character is, I mean, she's got this fantastic line where she's like, if I had a dick, this would be the point I'd tell you to suck it. I was just like, that is fantastic. I just wish the other two female leads were kind of a bit more well-rounded. You know, most of their lines contained stuff about, I don't like ticks and I don't like outside here and you're all backwards because you're country people. It was just a bit like, oh, shut up. Like, no one talks like this. So would you recommend Lake Placid to horror fans?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, when people think of the big alligator or croc films, it's probably definitely up there. And, you know, 99, same year as Deep Blue Sea, which is a similarly sort of slightly dumb, slightly hokey, but very fun shark film. And I think, you know, shark films of that ilk now are definitely what's sort of running the landscape today. And there needs to be more room for crocs, I think. I think I mentioned earlier, Crawl, a very, very good recent one that does that thing of just taking, you know, woman versus beast and just setting it in a very specific place. That's definitely one to check out as well. But this year, I haven't seen the sequels or the eventual crossover with Anaconda. Lake Placid versus Anaconda, I think it is. Like, is the lake fighting the snake? Like, the shark in Jaws just being called Jaws every time. It's like, that's not his name. This croc is not Lake Placid. But it is funny how it takes 8 years for there to be the first direct-to-DVD sequel when the end of this, you know, does kind of set one up in that they have just captured it. They haven't killed it by the end. And when we see it being carted away on the back of that truck, like King Kong style. But yeah, I think there's a lot of fun to be had here. I think if you're after, like, you know, nonstop kills, you might be a bit disappointed. But I think what it, you know, sacrifices in that, it makes back in genuinely considered sort of, you know, is always there. I think the restraint is quite nice to see. But then, you know, you do get some big action stuff towards the end as well. So yeah.
Yeah, I would recommend it because, you know, as someone who's not a fan of creature features, I really enjoyed it. And I think that's a big kind of, that's a big tell. It's
has
really
it, has
enjoyable.
It made you want to check out many others?
You know what? I'm not going to go right now. Mainly because I have a massive to-be watch list that, you know. But I would, if someone said to me, let's put Anaconda on, I'd be like, you know, okay, fair enough. But yeah, I might go check out Crawl now. I think I might pop that on my list.
Because that's a really good time. Really good time at the movies. You know, it's that does the rising tension really well. Just looking up Anaconda real quick. Oh, it's 97. Because I thought if that was 99 as well, then that was the
that
year.
That had Jennifer Lopez in it, did it? And Ice-T?
Yeah. So Ice Cube.
Ice Cube, sorry.
Yeah, another one with a stacked cast. It's Jennifer Lopez, Ice Cube, John Voight, Eric Stoltz, Owen Wilson, Carrie Werher, and Danny Trejo. It's like, yeah.
Maybe I will put it on my list then.
There you go.
So out of the two films, if someone said, I want to watch only one creature feature tonight, and you had to recommend, which one would you?
Or I think I'd probably still go Blob at this point. Yeah, because of, I think the way that Blob as I've said, it comes slap in the middle of this sort of timeline or creature feature trends, and it covers so much. So I think you could watch that, and if you knew nothing kind of about the subgenre, you could be like, oh, okay, this is, you know, remaking a 50s one, which is where it all began. It's very much based in that 80s filmmaking style and aesthetic, and also, you know, it holds up really well as well. So I think it's a really good all-rounder for that. Plus, you know, it really does have that sort of watch at the drive-in feel. It looks great. You know, we've often said in our other shows, like, films good or bad, especially bad ones from the 80s or 90s, tend to just look better than bad films now, because even if it's terrible, it was still shot on film, it was still shot on locations. There's a lot more practicality to everything, really. So it's great just to have that in there. But, you know, luckily it's not bad. It's very good. So, yeah, I'd go Blob.
I'd go Lake Placid, just for Betty White, kind of alone.
Betty White.
Exactly. So thank you so much for coming on and chatting about creature features. I know we kind of touched on it a little bit, but what do you think is the future for creature features?
Ooh, so yeah, so I'd love to see them come back properly. And I think you can, like The Blob does, I think you can weigh up films that are semi-homages to like the 50s and 70s, but also can play in a more modern sandpit. I think you can get really creative with your creatures. I'd love to see like a studio take some risks on them, or like a Blumhouse or somewhere, or even Universal, because they did, you know, put Cocaine Bear out there, of just going like, here's like 10 to 15 million, do as best you can with this, and go all in on being real. And whether that means you keep it contained, keep it small, but put the money in where it counts, or going slightly bigger, whatever works. But I think, I don't know if there's any actual creatures left that haven't been turned into one of these films. I don't know, maybe
Capybara.
Maybe a donkey. I don't know. Rampaging donkeys. Oh, and the rooster, of course.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot of fun. You can almost pull stuff out of a hat. Like one hat is all the monsters, creatures. One hat is locations or situations, and then mash it together. But I definitely want to see more. And I think hopefully there's still a good healthy mix of your lower budget end and studio stuff. If the studio stuff carries on, like stuff like the Meg 2, which they obviously are, I just hope they use the resources better and give us proper casts again and proper drama, you know, outside of the creature scenes to really make it more timeless. I think if you just go for the shock factor or lead into too much else, then you lose a bit of timelessness.
Yeah. Okay, before we go, I always ask my guests, what is your favorite horror film?
Oh my word. I'm gonna... Oh man. So even if 2's definitely up there, that definitely left an impression. I think I'll pick something recent, like It Follows. I really love that. Stands up every time. I've had a lot of fun with that in showing it to various housemates over the years, who inevitably crap their pants in all the right places. I think that's a really, really good piece of work. On the slasher side, I'm very much a Freddy guy. So I think Nightmare 1 or Dream Warriors. But I think it comes down to Evil Dead and Scream, as mentioned, as being the most consistent horror franchises with no real duffers. So Evil Dead 2 from Evil Dead and original Scream from Scream. But Scream, especially now, as it's really picking up its stride again and putting out really great entries now, they're ones that every now and then I'm like, yeah, I could sit and do a Scream 1-6 run through. Yeah.
That's great. And where can people find you on social media if they wish to do so?
You can find me at Matt Brothers 2 on Twitter. I don't know who got the clean Matt Brothers, but I hate
them.
And across those three pods as well. So at Is Paul Dano Okay? Or Is Paul Dano Okay? We've recently just finished all of his films. So what we're doing is we're doing various mini series looking at other character actors. So we've already done a Judy Greer one. And we have plans for others coming out later this year. And at Sun Double Deep for Sun Double Deep, the Triple Bill titled podcast, and at Spotlight Pod for Spotlight, where a lot of our time recently has been spent catching up on all the new stuff. So I think round about the time we started that podcast, it was just after Star Trek Beyond had come out. So it felt like that's it. Trek's done. We can just play catch up. And then not long after, they announced Discovery and all the slew of all the other shows that have come. Yeah. So it feels like we've been forever playing catch up, but we've still got Picard season 3, Prodigy season 1, part 2, Strange New World season 2, all these ones that we're just covering, doing like a big summary roundup in one episode. But every now and then we do a thing called Spotlight of the Movies as well, which is where we look at a film that isn't Star Trek, but involves somebody either in front or behind the camera from Star Trek. So our first one was Three Men and a Baby, which is directed by Leonard Nimoy himself. And it's like that. So we did a recent one on the new Dungeons and Dragons as it stars Chris Pine. So that's a real fun way for us to chat about non-Star Trek stuff on a Star Trek show as well.
So that was my chat there with Matt from Is Paul Dano OK? the podcast. And together we chatted about two creature features. That is 1999's Lake Placid, the massive crocodile film, as well as the 1988 remake of The Blob. Let me know, what did you think of this week's episode? Do you like creature features? Are you a fan? Am I just ignorant to the treasure trove that is the creature feature subgenre? Let me know on Twitter at @what_scream or Instagram at @whatascream. And don't forget to rate, review, subscribe on whatever podcast platform you are listening to me on. I would really appreciate that. Thank you very much. Next week, I am going to be talking about a genre that defined the early 2000s. And I guess it was one of those genres that created such a media uproar in this time period, because it was thought to be like super extreme cinema. And that subject is torture porn. I love a good torture porn. I do. Something about it that I find really interesting. About what it says of the early 2000s and the society we were in at the time. So my special guest is Kinnell from Kinnell's Sinister Cinema. And we are chatting about two quite big, one's quite underrated actually, films. So yes, tune in next week to hear what films we are talking about within the torture porn genre. Thank you so much for listening, and don't forget to stay horrific. Goodbye.